Thank you for downloading this podcast of Dave Day talking about 18th century boxing entrepreneurs at MMU's Institute for Performance Research Symposium on Sporting Lives, held on December the 4th, 2010. Topic is 18th century entrepreneurs, particularly related to boxing. And when I say 18th century, I'm not talking about the boxing mania at the end of the 18th century. I'm talking really about the first 50 years, the first real period where boxing was regarded as a national activity. Now, during the 18th century, the English economy underwent an accelerated structural transformation in which industry came into greater prominence. Industrialisation and urbanisation led to reductions in both the time to engage in ludic activities and the space to participate in them, although in developing urban areas it was insufficient working class spending power that limited access to sports, as powerful economic influences acted to change traditional pursuits. A combination of increasing population growth and rapid urbanisation created an environment for the enterprising to exploit, and the entrepreneurial response from leisure providers, especially in London, was dynamic. As examples, Gough's illuminated amphitheatre in Aldergate Street presented a variety of paintings of fruit and flowers in 1743, together with representations of regimental soldiers in battle dress, under a branch of lights and 28 pier glasses about 9 feet high, all for sixpence per head. Professional anatomy teachers lectured to anyone who bought a ticket, and there were anatomical waxwork exhibitions at venues such as Rackstrow's Public Museum in the Strand. Sporting entrepreneurs like George Smith at the Artillery Ground promoted foot racing and cricket, although the difficulties they faced were reflected by his announcement in 1744 that recent disorders meant that in future he would be charging each spectator sixpence and establishing a ring of benches sufficient to accommodate 800 gentlemen. Only the players and those appointed to keep order would be permitted within this ring. Swimming was advertised at the Peerless Pool behind the bowling green in Old Street, which had been converted in 1743 by William Kemp into a bath where gentlemen could safely learn to swim. Waiters attended to teach swimming if required. Thomas Higginson, who kept the fives court in St Martin Street, offered fives, rackets or hand fives for tuppence a game. He had other tennis courts facing the Haymarket and in High Holborn, where there were also two billiard tables. The rougher sports of the lower classes were also contained and packaged for financial gain, and it is this process, particularly the men involved in establishing the provision for boxing in London, that occupies the following discussion. 18th century popular culture was marked by disorder, and a high level of physical violence was evident both in daily life and in recreational activities. At the boarded house in Marylebone Fields in July 1721, there was a match between a panther and 12 dogs for £300. A bear and an ass were baited, and a bull had turned loose with fireworks all over him and bulldogs after him. Combat sports had been practised by all classes in the 16th century, and although their personal involvement had diminished during the 17th century, the aristocracy gradually rediscovered an interest in those sports practised by their social inferiors. In 1681, a boxing match between his footman and a butcher was performed before the Duke of Albemarle, and in March 1705, the Spanish ambassador staged a boxing match between his footman and those of his gentlemen. Many early 18th century boxing matches took place at inns, such as John Spencer's The Black Dog at Kentish Town, where supporters of boxing congregated in 1724, or in the open air, although there were always problems in staging contests in ad hoc locations. A match in Islington between Tom Romaine, a pipe maker, and Jack Stareabout, a butcher, in 1738, ended in confusion when the butchers, recognising that their man was being beaten, interrupted a contest and a general skirmish ensued about the stakes and the buybets. There were some specialist facilities, such as Preston's Amphitheatre or the Royal Bear Garden, situated near Hockley in the Hole, Clerkenwell, where diversions included wrestling, boxing, cudgelling, fighting at backswords, quarterstaff and bear baiting. The amphitheatre was 150 to 200 feet square, surrounded by tiers of benches for spectators to sit at different prices, and under which were dens for the bears and bulls to be baited. In the middle was a large stage for the fighters, men who included James Figg, Ned Sutton, James Stokes and John Broughton. Oxfordshire man James Figg is credited with being the first person to commercialise boxing and to develop it as a business when in 1719, with the help of the Earl of Peterborough, he set up a school of arms in Tottenham Court Road, where his amphitheatre attracted the patronage of the upper classes. His acquaintances included Prime Minister Sir Robert Walpole, essayist Jonathan Swift, poet Alexander Pope, and William Hogarth the artist. And both he and his facility contributed to the popularity of pugilism throughout the first half of the century. He was athletic, strong, courageous, and he became acknowledged as the best boxer in England, described though by Egan as more of a slaughterer than a neat finished pugilist. Figg fought sparingly and remained unbeaten in a career which spanned 11 years, but he could never unambiguously be identified as a boxer, since his business card, which was engraved by Hogarth, emphasised his prize fighting skills, not his boxing skills. Boxing does not appear on his card. He was best known as a teacher, proving so successful that he later relocated to larger premises. It was from among the younger members of the aristocracy that Figg drew most of his clientele, and this universal support for the activity is reflected in Fielding's novels, which abound with exponents of combat sports. Fielding, like many of his contemporaries, recognised the constant association between boxing and English nationalism, recognised by the contest between Whittaker, who was a student of Figg's, and De Carney, a Venetian, in 1733, which Whittaker won by employing the English peg to the stomach. Figg, who seems to be one of the first entrepreneurs to appreciate the value of publicity and advertising, immediately capitalised on the interest surrounding this event by announcing that he had another fighter who would challenge the winner, and a week later, very near as great and fine a company as the week before, watched Peartree defeat Whittaker in only 6 minutes. Over the course of his career, Figg fought Edward Sutton on a number of occasions, and Sutton was involved in establishing another amphitheatre in conjunction with prize fighter James Stokes during the 1720s. Based in Islington Road, the venue advertised boxing matches from the start of 1727. Thomas Allen, or Pipes, and John Gretton fought for £200 in May 1730, while John Broughton fought Pipes for considerable sums in 1730 and 1731, and again in 1732, when these men of the first rank, well known in London for their bravery and great skill, boxed for £50. By 1731, Stokes, his pupils being equal in birth and fortune to any in England, had decided to retire and concentrate on teaching and on his commercial enterprise, where he included attractions such as boxing match between boys in 1730 and contests featuring female boxers, especially his wife Elizabeth, the English championess. In 1730, Elizabeth was challenged by four women who had come to London specifically to fight her, and even though she'd been intending to retire, she agreed to fight them one after the other at her husband's facility. In 1732, Stokes noted that the European championess, Mrs. Stokes, had fought 45 times, the last before several British noblemen and the Duke of Lavaine, and that she still remained unbeaten. Boxing continued at Stokes' amphitheatre to share the stage with other entertainments. In May 1731, bull bear baiting, an ass and a bull addressed with fireworks and cockfighting all preceded Pipes Against Broughton for 100 guineas. In 1732, Stokes advertised that his firework bull would be turned loose among the gamesters, and anyone quitting before all the combustibles were discharged would forfeit 5 shillings. The ground was railed 10 feet deep to prevent danger and raised 2 feet higher for the better prospect of the gentlemen. He actually said the meaner sort of people were requested not to attend because they actually affronted the gentlemen. In July, Stokes presented a new opera at the amphitheatre called Ruler Bear and Have a Bear, and announced that he had purchased a wolf from France, the beautifulest creature seen in England. Thomas Sibless, who had appeared at Stokes's amphitheatre, in 1730, Thomas Sibless from Worcestershire, who was previously a scholar of figs, having received some invectives from Stokes because he erected a drinking booth and hung up a sword in a field near his amphitheatre, challenged Stokes, who agreed to fight this Herculean champion. A year later, an advertisement for Figgs's Great Room noted that Figg had retired and taken a house in Poland Street to teach gentlemen, and it appears that Sibless took over this facility, subsequently referred to as Mr. Sibylus's Great Room, the late Mr. Figgs, where he was busy promoting Broughton against Birch in November 1732 and Broughton against Ravington in June 1733, when he also advertised himself in a prize-fighting challenge as Citizen and Dyer, Professor of the said science. In 1734, George Taylor acquired the amphitheatre from Sibless, and he enjoyed considerable success as a manager and showman. Known as George the Barber, Taylor made his first appearances at Figg's amphitheatre alongside Broughton, who was the only man to beat him, supposedly because Taylor actually lacked bottom courage. His advertisements were graphic, and like Figg, he used the press to publish challenges. Taylor charged an expensive 2 shillings and 6 pence for entrance, and a day's takings of £150 were not uncommon. He also ran an academy where gentlemen were taught self-defence, and he may also modelled as an artist model at St Martin's Lane, where Hogarth taught. At the start of the 1740s, Taylor had successful fights against Boswell and Stevenson, and his business was flourishing, but Broughton left him in 1742 and a year later opened a more comfortable amphitheatre. Taylor tried to respond, declaring that his facility had been commodiously altered for the better entertainment of the gentlemen at very large expense, but he was eventually forced to close and fight for Broughton. Although he later left to become landlord of the Fountain Inn, Deptford, he fought again in 1758, losing to Tom Faulkner, and he died the same year. Like other pugilistic entrepreneurs, his networks included nobility and artists, and it was Hogarth who produced the designs for his tombstone. The best remembered of the boxing entrepreneurs was John Jack Broughton, another pupil of Figg's, who appeared at Taylor's booth and fought for both Stokes and Sibless in the 1730s. Now, Broughton, who was considered champion from the mid-1730s until 1750, was a powerful man, muscular enough for Rysbrack to use as a model for his statue of Hercules. But he also brought method into boxing by introducing scientific techniques. Patronised by the Duke of Cumberland, Broughton was intelligent and courteous, and under his influence, boxing became a specialised activity. His contribution was significant, not only for his development of skills, but for his introduction of rules and the success of his amphitheatre. In 1743, he used the money he'd earned from fighting, along with contributions from patrons, to open an amphitheatre dedicated to the art of boxing and structured to prevent the gentry's being incommoded by the populace. Broughton justified his role as instigator of this enterprise by citing his invincibility and esteem within the boxing community and emphasising that his physical presence would ensure decency and decorum. He also opened an academy to teach boxing where he provided mufflers to avoid black eyes and bloody noses. Gentlemen could have lessons at home, and anyone contributing to the amphitheatre would be admitted free of charge to public classes. This new amphitheatre was adjacent to Taylor's premises, as I said before, and Taylor responded by publicly accusing Broughton of swindling fighters. Broughton argued that since he had contributed £400 of his own money to supplement the £80 raised by subscription, it was only reasonable that he should take a third of the door money. In the end, all the principal amateurs of the science supported Broughton, forcing Taylor and his boxers to fight for Broughton. The amphitheatre prospered, and by the time Taylor beat Slack in 1750, receipts sometimes amounted to £300 a day. From 1744, Broughton devoted his time to running his academy and giving private lessons. And then when he did take to the stage again in 1750, he suffered his first defeat in losing to Slack. Although it's been suggested the facility was closed following this defeat, under pressure from Cumberland, who'd lost a lot of money, £10,000 apparently, as a wager, it was still operating in 1752. One author correctly forecast at this point, however, that once the populace of distinction, people like Cumberland, withdrew their support from the amphitheatres, these vile seminaries of insolence and disturbance, the magistracy would then soon suppress them, and by 1754 they had closed. Boxing matches were driven out of London, and boxing did not revive until the 1780s. Broughton himself ran an antiques business and a furniture warehouse, as well as continuing to teach boxing. And when he died in 1789, the last of the old-time pugilists, his entrepreneurial talents were reflected in his leaving an estate worth around £7,000. There's a couple of points that I want to make, really, in drawing these lives together, or this community of entrepreneurs together. The first half of the 18th century clearly witnessed significant developments in boxing in London, driven by entrepreneurs who used their knowledge of the activity, their business acumen and their aristocratic contacts to develop facilities in which they controlled the fighters and the direction of the sport itself. The popularity of boxing did not survive the passing of these men and the closing of their amphitheatres, and it was 30 years before the activity regained the same degree of aristocratic support. This has led some scholars to conclude that the closing, most notably Brailsford, to conclude that the closing of Broughton's amphitheatre retarded the development of boxing, since it became an illegal activity which was forced to compete with legal activities like cricket and racing, which could establish permanent venues, advertise, charge for admission and pay performers a steady income. For other scholars, the closure of the amphitheatres actually prevented boxing from eventually becoming merely an exhibition managed by a few showmen, since it had been clearly in the interest of entrepreneurs and fighters to control the activity and extend their own careers by exhibiting in easily supervised facilities rather than engaging in full-blooded contests in the open air. The argument that they use is that it is unlikely that boxing would have developed as a cult and a national preoccupation in the Regency period had it remained confined to the amphitheatres in the towns and cities. The second point I want to make is whichever position one adopts on this issue, there is no doubting the impact of these individuals and their collective community had on the development of boxing in this period, and ultimately on the development of modern sport. 18th century industrialisation brought with it the concept of achievement through improved performance, and the expansion of interest in pugilism has combined with a growing appreciation of the importance of appropriate training and instruction, the roots of which had appeared when Figg took responsibility for one fighter's instruction and proper diet in 1725. By the time the amphitheatres were just being closed, it was already being argued that an expanding competitive programme for bruisers would lead gentlemen to keep champions in training, put them in sweats, diet them, and breed up the human species with the same care as they do cocks and horses. Tellingly, the same author believed that as a result, this branch of gaming would doubtless be reduced to a science, something which is a familiar concept within our contemporary sporting world. Thank you.